left all black. Then they bleached a single stripe all white down the center of its back. Then, with surgery, they put in its body a sack of super smelly yucky stuff, just like a skunk has. When they were all done, the animal looked like this, shows picture of skunk. After the operation, was this a skunk or a raccoon? Doctors took a coffee pot that looked like this, shows picture of a coffee pot. They sawed off the handle, sealed the top, took off the top knob, closed the spout, and sawed it off. They also sawed off the base and attached a flat piece of metal. They attached a little stick, cut a window in it, and filled the metal container with bird food. When they were done, it looked like this, shows picture of a bird feeder. After the operation, was this a coffee pot or a bird feeder? Doctors took this toy, shows picture of a wind-up bird. You wind it up with a key, and its mouth opens and a little machine inside plays music. The doctors did an operation on it. They put on real feathers to make it look nice and soft, and they gave it a better beak. Then they took off the wind-up key and put in a new machine so that it flapped its wings and flew, and chirped, shows picture of a bird. After the operation, was it a real bird or a toy bird? For artifacts like a coffee pot turning into a bird feeder, or a deck of cards turning into toilet paper, the children accepted the changes at face value. A bird feeder is anything that is meant to feed birds, so that thing is a bird feeder. But for natural kinds like a raccoon turning into a skunk, or a grapefruit turning into an orange, they were more resistant. There was some invisible raccoonhood lingering in the skunk's clothing, and they were less likely to say that the new creature was a skunk. As for violations of the boundary between artifacts and natural kinds, like a toy turning into a bird, or a porcupine turning into a hairbrush, they were adamant. A bird is a bird, and a toy is a toy. Keel also showed that children are uncomfortable with the idea of a horse that has cow insides, and cow parents and cow babies, even though they have no problem with a key that is made of melted down pennies, and is then melted down to make pennies again. And of course adults from other cultures have the same sorts of intuitions. Illiterate rural Nigerians were given the following kind of question. Some students took a pawpaw, shows picture of a pawpaw, and stuck some green pointy leaves on the top. Then they put small prickly patches all over it. Now it looks like this, shows picture of a pineapple. Is it a pawpaw or a pineapple? A typical response was, it's a pawpaw, because a pawpaw has its own structure from heaven and a pineapple its own origin. One cannot turn into the other. Little children also sense that animal kinds fall into larger categories, and their generalizations follow the similarity defined by category membership, not mere similarity of appearance. Susan Gelman and Ellen Markman showed 3-year-old children a picture of a flamingo, a picture of a bat, and a picture of a blackbird, which looked a lot more like the bat than like the flamingo. They told the kids that a flamingo feeds its babies mashed-up food, but a bat feeds its babies milk, and asked them what the blackbird feeds its babies. With no further information, children went by appearances and predicted milk. But all it took was a mention that flamingos and blackbirds were birds, and the children lumped them together and predicted mashed-up food. And if you really doubt that we have botany instincts, consider one of the oddest of human motives, looking at flowers. A huge industry specializes in breeding and growing flowers for people to use in decorating dwellings and parks. Some research shows that bringing flowers to hospital patients is more than a warm gesture. It may actually improve the patient's mood and recovery rate. Since people rarely eat flowers, this diversion of effort and resources seems inexplicably frivolous. But if we evolved as intuitive botanists, it makes some sense. A flower is a microfiche of botanical information. When plants are not in bloom, they blend into a sea of green. A flower is often the only way to identify a plant species, even for a professional taxonomist. Flowers also signal seasons and terrains of expected bounty, and the exact locations of future fruits and seeds. A motive to pay attention to flowers and to be where they are would obviously have been useful in environments where there were no year-round salad bars. Intuitive biology is, of course, very different from what professors of biology do in their laboratories. But professional biology may have an intuitive biology at its foundation. Folk taxonomy was obviously the predecessor to Linnaean taxonomy, and even today, professional taxonomists rarely contradict indigenous tribes when they classify the local species. The intuitive conviction that living things have a hidden essence and are governed by hidden processes is clearly what impelled the first professional biologists to try to understand the nature of plants and animals by bringing them into the laboratory and putting bits of them under a microscope. Anyone who announced he was trying to understand the nature of chairs by bringing them into a laboratory and putting bits of them under a microscope would surely be dismissed as mad, not given a grant. Indeed, probably all of science and mathematics is driven by intuitions coming from innate modules like number, mechanics, mental maps, even law. Physical analogies, heat is a fluid, electrons are particles, visual metaphors, linear function, rectangular matrix, and social and legal terminology, attraction, obeying laws, are used throughout science. And if you will allow me to sneak in one more offhand remark that really deserves a book of its own, I would guess that most other human cultural practices, competitive sports, narrative literature, landscape design, ballet, no matter how much they seem like arbitrary outcomes of a Borghesian lottery, are clever technologies we have invented to exercise and stimulate mental modules that were originally designed for specific adaptive functions. So the language instinct suggests a mind of adapted computational modules rather than the blank slate, lump of wax, or general-purpose computer of the standard social science model. But what does this view say about the secular ideology of equality and opportunity that the model has provided us? If we abandon the SSSM, are we forced to repugnant doctrines like biological determinism? Let me begin with what I hope are obvious points. First, the human brain works however it works. Wishing for it to work in some way as a shortcut to justifying some ethical principle undermines both the science and the ethics. For what happens to the principle if the scientific facts turn out to go the other way? Second, there is no foreseeable discovery in psychology that could bear on the self-evident truth that ethically and politically, all people are created equal, that they are endowed with certain inalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Finally, radical empiricism is not necessarily a progressive humanitarian doctrine. A blank slate is a dictator's dream. Some psychology textbooks mention the fact that Spartan and samurai mothers smiled upon hearing that their sons fell in battle. Since history is written by generals, not mothers, we can dismiss this incredible claim. But it is clear what purposes it must have served. With those points out of the way, I do want to point out some implications of the theory of cognitive instincts for heredity and humankind, for they are the opposite of what many people expect. It is a shame that the following two claims are so often confused. Differences between people are innate. Commonalities among all people are innate. The two claims could not be more different. Take number of legs. The reason that some people have fewer legs than others is 100% due to the environment. The reason that all uninjured people have exactly two legs, rather than eight or six or none, is 100% due to heredity. But claims that a universal human nature is innate are often run together with claims that differences between individuals, sexes, or races are innate. One can see the misguided motive for running them together. If nothing in the mind is innate, then differences between people's minds cannot be innate. Thus it would be good if the mind had no structure, because then decent egalitarians would have nothing to worry about. But the logical inverse is false. Everyone could be born with identical, richly structured minds, and all differences among them would be bits of acquired knowledge and minor perturbations that accumulate through people's history of life experiences. So even for people who, inadvisably in my view, like to conflate science and ethics, there is no need for alarm at the search for innate mental structure, whatever the truth turns out to be. One reason innate commonalities and innate differences are so easy to confuse is that behavior geneticists, the scientists who study inherited deficits, identical and fraternal twins, adopted and biological children, and so on, have usurped the word heritable as a technical term referring to the proportion of variation in some trait that correlates with genetic differences within a species. This sense is different from the everyday term inherited or genetic, which refers to traits whose inherent structure or organization comes from information in the genes. Something can be ordinarily inherited but show zero heritability, like number of legs at birth or the basic structure of the mind. Conversely, something can be not inherited but have 100% heritability. Imagine a society where all and only the red-haired people were made priests. Priesthood would be highly heritable, though of course not inherited in any biologically meaningful sense. For this reason, people are bound to be confused by claims like intelligence is 70% heritable, especially when the news magazines report them in the same breath, as they inevitably do, alas, with research in cognitive science on the basic workings of the mind. All claims about a language instinct and other mental modules are claims about the commonalities among all normal people. They have virtually nothing to do with possible genetic differences between people. One reason is that, to a scientist interested in how complex biological systems work, differences between individuals are so boring. Imagine what a dreary science of language we would have if, instead of trying to figure out how people put words together to express their thoughts, researchers have begun by developing a language quotient, LQ scale, and busied themselves by measuring thousands of people's relative language skills. It would be like asking how lungs work and being told that some people have better lungs than others, or asking how compact discs reproduce sound and being given a consumer magazine that ranked them, instead of an explanation of digital sampling and lasers. But emphasizing commonalities is not just a matter of scientific taste. The design of any adaptive biological system, the explanation of how it works, is almost certain to be uniform across individuals in a sexually reproducing species, because sexual recombination would fatally scramble the blueprints for qualitatively different designs. There is, to be sure, a great deal of genetic diversity among individuals. Each person is biochemically unique. But natural selection is a process that feeds on that variation. And, aside from functionally equivalent varieties of molecules, when natural selection creates adaptive designs, it does so by using the variation up. The variant genes that specify more poorly designed organs disappear when their owners starve, get eaten, or die mateless. To the extent that mental modules are complex products of natural selection, genetic variation will be limited to quantitative variations, not differences in basic design. Genetic differences among people, no matter how fascinating they are to us in love, biography, personnel, gossip, and politics, are of minor interest to us when we appreciate what makes minds intelligent at all. Similarly, an interest in mind design puts possible innate differences between sexes, as a psycholinguist I refuse to call them genders, and races in a new light. With the exception of the maleness-determining gene on the Y chromosome, every functioning gene in a man's body is also found in a woman's, and vice versa. The maleness gene is a developmental switch that can activate some suites of genes and deactivate others, but the same blueprints are in both kinds of bodies, and the default condition is identity of design. There is some evidence that the sexes depart from this default in the case of the psychology of reproduction and the adaptive problems directly and indirectly related to it, which is not surprising. It seems unlikely that peripherals as different as the male and female reproductive systems would come with the same software. But the sexes face essentially similar demands for most of the rest of cognition, including language, and I would be surprised if there were differences in design between them. Race and ethnicity are the most minor differences of all. The human geneticists Walter Bodmer and Luca Cavalli-Sforza have noted a paradox about race. Among lay people, race is lamentably salient, but for biologists, it is virtually invisible. 85% of human genetic variation consists of the differences between one person and another within the same ethnic group, tribe, or nation. Another 8% is between ethnic groups, and a mere 7% is between races. In other words, the genetic difference between, say, two randomly picked Swedes is about 12 times as large as the genetic difference between the average of Swedes and the average of Apaches or Walpiris. Bodmer and Cavalli-Sforza suggest that the illusion is the result of an unfortunate coincidence. Many of the systemic differences among races are adaptations to climate. Melanin protects skin against the tropical sun. Eyelid folds insulate eyes from dry cold and snow. But the skin, the part of the body seen by the weather, is also the part of the body seen by other people. Race is, quite literally, skin deep. But to the extent that perceivers generalize from external to internal differences, nature has duped them into thinking that race is important. The X-ray vision of the molecular geneticist reveals the unity of our species. And so does the X-ray vision of the cognitive scientist. Not speaking the same language is a virtual synonym for incommensurability, but to a psycholinguist it is a superficial difference. Knowing about the ubiquity of complex language across individuals and cultures and the single mental design underlying them all, no speech seems foreign to me, even when I cannot understand a word. The banter among New Guinean Highlanders in the film of their first contact with the rest of the world, the motions of a sign language interpreter, the prattle of little girls in a Tokyo playground. I imagine seeing through the rhythms to the structures underneath and sense that we all have the same minds. The language instinct today. Many fields of science enjoy a rapid rate of new discoveries and a high degree of consensus about what they mean. The study of language, unfortunately for linguistics, but perhaps fortunately for the language instinct, is not among them. A book on human genetics or nanotechnology would be hopelessly out of date a dozen years after its publication, but I like to think that the language instinct is still a useful introduction to the science of language today. Of course, the field has hardly stood still, nor have my opinions, and here are some reflections on the contents of each chapter in the light of developments since 1994. Chapter 1. An Instinct to Acquire an Art. The two heroes of this chapter are very much in the spotlight today. Darwin's influence has expanded in psychology, the social sciences, philosophy, medicine, and genomics, despite the retrograde efforts of the intelligent design movement, and in my 2002 book, The Blank Slate, explored some of the ramifications of his influence. Chomsky is still the most influential living linguist, and his political writings have inspired a new generation of leftists. I recently saw a sticker on a lamppost that read, "Read Chomsky." Many readers concluded from this chapter's acknowledgement of Chomsky's influence on linguistics that I am a Chomskyan. In some regards, the view that language comes from a mental system tailored for the computation of symbolic representations, I am. But in the chapter I hinted at some disagreements, and I have spelled them out in the years since. In The Blank Slate, I explained why I don't share Chomsky's romantic view of human nature, or the radical leftist anarchist politics connected to it. and he and I have locked horns in a recent debate on grammatical theory and the evolution of language. More on this later. My views on language and mind are very close to those of my comrade in that debate, the linguist Ray Jackendoff, himself a former student of Chomsky's. Jackendoff lays out a coherent vision for the science of language in his recent book, Foundations of Language, which I endorse wholeheartedly. Chapter 2. Chatterboxes. Many of the phenomena discussed in this natural history of language have made the news in the past dozen years. In 2005, the linguist Daniel Everett described an Amazonian people, the Piraha, whose language, he suggested, did not allow them to describe abstract subjects lying outside their immediate experience. That claim, though, was belied by many of his own observations, such as that spirits and the spirit world play a very large role in their lives. Though Piraha is in some ways simpler than familiar European languages, it has a one-too-many counting system and simpler systems of tenses and pronouns. In other ways, it is quite complex, with 16 verb suffix classes and more than 50,000 attested word forms. Everett has emphasized that, contrary to causal impressions, Piraha is by no means a primitive language. Black English vernacular made the news in 1996 under the wacky name Ebonics, when members of the Oakland School Board floated a suggestion that it be recognized as a language in their bilingual education programs. The linguists John McWhorter and Jeffrey Pullum have written excellent analyses of the resulting hoo-ha. Anne Senghas was a research assistant in the project that first studied Nicaraguan Sign Language, and when she came to MIT as my graduate student, I suggested that she study this fascinating phenomenon in her thesis and beyond. She has since published beautiful quantitative analyses demonstrating that the younger children have indeed developed a new language with a discrete combinatorial grammar. Many readers were surprised to read of cultures where parents say little to their small children, who acquire language from older siblings and peers. But their surprise is a symptom of what Judith Rich Harris has exposed as the nurture assumption, the dogma that children are socialized by their parents. In her famous 1998 book by that title, she argued that the most important influence parents have on their children is at the moment of conception. Children acquire their culture and develop their personalities in their interactions with their peer groups and society. Many features of language acquisition bear this out. The dispensability of parental speech in language acquisition, the phenomenon of creolization, the emergence of Nicaraguan Sign Language, and the fact that children of immigrants always grow up with the accents of their peers, not those of their parents. These phenomena, together with the findings of behavioral genetics, made me receptive to Harris's theory, and I wrote a foreword to her book and discussed it at length in The Blank Slate. Though Chomsky is famous for advancing the hypothesis that language is innate, he has never laid out a systematic scientific defense of the claim, and his main argument, the poverty of the input, is far from watertight. Jeff Pullum and the philosopher Barbara Schultz, using large bodies of online text, the most prominent new methodology in linguistics, have shown that many constructions children allegedly never hear can, in fact, be found in reasonably sized samples of English. They don't deny that a poverty of the input argument can be made, and I think that the Simon study, Nicaraguan Sign Language, and Peter Gordon's Mice Eater study, reported in Chapter 5, are good candidates, but they point out, reasonably in my view, that they are harder to nail down than Chomsky and most of his followers assume. Human genetics and cognitive neuroscience are two areas that have exploded since the book came out. Williams syndrome is now known to be caused by the deletion of a small region of chromosome 7 containing some 20 genes, which accounts for the heterogeneous symptoms of the syndrome. At least one of them, the gene for LIM kinase 1, has been associated with the problems in spatial cognition. Though the language of people with Williams syndrome is, as I emphasized, less impaired than other cognitive functions, there is a lot of variation among the affected people. The hyper-developed language abilities of Crystal, though showing that language can dissociate from other aspects of cognition, are not found in all people with the syndrome. Progress in understanding the genetics of K family has been spectacular. First, a marker for the gene was identified, SPCH1, then the gene itself, FOXP2, together with the mutation that leads to the deficit, then its evolutionary history. The gene has counterparts in other mammals, but the exact sequence of the normal human version is unique to us, and it has been a target of Darwinian natural selection during the past 200,000 years. Currently, its function in mammalian brain development is being studied intensively. We now know that it is a transcription factor that turns on other genes, and that the versions in other mammals affect neural circuitry for motor control, particularly the circuits for making sounds. Despite my cautious characterization of what was known about the family's syndrome in Chapter 10, I have seen myself cited as claiming both that the affected gene was specific to grammar and that it affects nothing but control of the muscles of the mouth and face. The family members have since undergone many tests, and the truth lies somewhere in between. The affected members have deficits in articulation and in oral and facial motor control, and have, on average, reduced intelligence. But they also have impairments in language itself that cannot be reduced to these other deficits. Though no single gene specific to grammar has been identified, and perhaps none ever will, it is increasingly clear that sets of genes will be tied with varying degrees of specificity and overlap with other functions to aspects of language ability. The psychologist Heather van der Lely has documented a group of children with a syndrome she calls grammatical-specific language impairment. Unlike that of the K family, their deficit appears to be specific to language itself, indeed specific to grammar. They are normal in overall intelligence, in interpreting complex sounds, in understanding words, and in using language in a natural way in social settings. Their syndrome is probably inherited, but the families are not large enough, or the pattern of inheritance clean enough to pin down the genes. Coming from the other direction, my former student Karen Stromswald has reviewed a large literature showing that many kinds of variation in language ability, including language impairment and language delay, are highly heritable. Chapter 3. Mentalese. When I wrote this chapter, the Whorfian hypothesis was largely out of favor among linguists and psychologists, but the pendulum has swung back, and there is now a lively neo-Whorfian movement. In The Stuff of Thought, I review this new research and argue that the problem with the idea that language affects thought is not that it's entirely wrong, but that there are many ways in which language can affect thought, and people tend to blur them together. In particular, people tend to confuse banal observations, such as that one person's words can affect another person's thoughts. If that weren't true, language as a whole would be useless, with radical claims, such as that we think in our native language, and that the language we speak makes it impossible to think certain thoughts. In the new book, I argue that the major conclusion in Mentalese is right. We think not in our native language, but in more abstract media of thought. Chapter 4. How Language Works. The machinery of syntax described at the end of this chapter is barely recognizable in Chomsky's current theory, which he calls the minimalist program. Chomsky is famous within linguistics for overturning his theory every decade or so. The current release, depending on how you count, is 5.2, whereas the release I presented in this chapter was a stripped-down version of 3.2, Revised Extended Standard Theory. Nonetheless, the picture of grammar presented here will be recognizable to anyone reading on in linguistics because I pretty much stuck to features that would stand the test of time and translate easily to other theories. In my own work, I have always favored theories with less exotic machinery than Chomsky's. Shallower trees, fewer traces, less movement, and whose structures are more visible at the surface, like phrases, lexical items, and constructions. Joan Bresnan's theory is an example, and a more recent version with this flavor can be found in Ray Jackendoff and Peter Kullakover's Simpler Syntax. The most stunning development since I wrote the chapter took place in 2004, when the Boston Red Sox won the World Series. Chapter 5. Words, words, words. In two subsequent books, I have explored the world of words in far greater depth. Words and Rules, The Ingredients of Language, looks at the combinatorial richness of word formation and its implications for the machinery of cognition. The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature, looks at the meanings of words and how they originate and spread. In his lovely book, How Children Learn the Meanings of Words, Paul Bloom argues that children have no mental mechanisms dedicated to word learning and learn a word the way they learn any other kind of fact. Children zero in on a word's meaning by exercising their theory of mind, or intuitive psychology, deducing what a sensible speaker is probably referring to in the context. Ray Jackendoff and I think this is not the whole story, for reasons we explained in our paper debating Chomsky. Chapter 6. The Sounds of Silence. Speech recognition technology has advanced tremendously and is now inescapable in telephone information systems. But as everyone who has been trapped in voicemail jail knows, the systems are far from foolproof. "I'm sorry, but I did not understand what you said." And here is how the novelist Richard Powers described his recent experience with a state-of-the-art speech recognition program. "This machine is a master of Spicos and Mondegreens. Just as we might hear the Psalms avow that, 'Surely good Mrs. Murphy shall follow me all the days of my life,' my tablet has changed 'book tour' to 'back to work,' and 'I truly couldn't see' to 'a cruelly good MC.'" Recognizing a large number of words from a large number of speakers is still a formidable engineering task. The sound pattern of English and the logic behind the vagaries of its spelling are explored more deeply in Words and Rules, including the extraordinary suggestion by Chomsky and Morris Halley that English spelling comes remarkably close to being an optimal orthographic system. One raging public debate involving language went unmentioned in The Language Instinct, the reading wars, or dispute over whether children should be explicitly taught to read by decoding the sounds of words from their spelling, loosely known as phonics, or whether they can develop it instinctively by being immersed in a text-rich environment, often called whole language. I tipped my hand at the paragraph in this chapter which said that language is an instinct, but reading is not. Like most psycholinguists, but apparently unlike many school boards, I think it's essential for children to be taught to become aware of speech sounds and how they are coded in strings of letters. Diane McGuinness's Why Our Children Can't Read is my favorite book on the subject. The title came from the publisher's Marketroids. She originally called it The Reading Revolution, since it was about both a scientific revolution in reading research and the revolution in human history that gave us alphabetic writing. Masaaki Yamanashi's comment on Bill Clinton proved to be prophetic. Chapter 7. Talking Heads. Anyone who has tried to search the web using one of the engines that claims to understand English can verify that comprehending natural language is still an unsolved engineering problem. Ditto for the programs that claim to translate from one language to another. The Loebner Prize competition, erroneously described as a Turing test, continues to be won by uncomprehending programs using canned responses. The subfield of linguistics known as pragmatics, which deals with the use of language in a social context and with phenomena such as politeness, innuendo, and reading between the lines, was covered in a scant 3 pages in this chapter. A deeper discussion which links these phenomena to social and evolutionary psychology can be found in a chapter called Games People Play in The Stuff of Thought. Chapter 8. The Tower of Babel. Daniel Everett, the linguist who documented the Amazonian language Piraha, claimed that the language violates Hackett's universals by providing no means to discuss events remote from experience, and by lacking the mechanism of recursive embedding, in which a word or phrase can be inserted inside a word or phrase of the same type. But the first claim, as I mentioned, is contradicted by numerous observations of the Piraha way of life, and the second is questionable as well. Piraha allows for a degree of semantic embedding using verb suffixes and conversions of nouns to verbs, so one can express the thought, I said that ko'oi intends to leave, with 2 levels of semantic embedding, and one can conjoin propositions within a sentence, as in, we ate a lot of the fish, but there was some fish we did not eat. The linguists Andrew Nevins, David Pasetsky, and Celine Rodriguez have taken a close look at Piraha and have disputed his claim that recursive syntactic embedding is absent from the language. The notion of universal grammar continues to be debated, though in a half-full, half-empty way. The proverbial Martian scientist would still consider human languages to be extraordinarily similar compared with the countless ways one could imagine a system for vocal communication. In The Atoms of Language, the linguist Mark Baker presents an explicit empirical case for a universal grammar, with a smallish set of parameters differentiating all human languages. My suggestion that controversies about language families might be resolved by a good statistician with a free afternoon has been taken up by a number of biostatisticians, though of course it is taking them more than an afternoon. In several cases, computer programs in biology that look at genes from a number of species and construct phylogenetic family trees have been applied to words from a number of languages in order to construct linguistic family trees. The programs are first tested on uncontroversial families, like Indo-European, to verify that they can replicate well-established trees. Then they are set to work on the murkier families, yielding both trees and the approximate dates at which proto-languages may have split off from their ancestors. Recent analyses of the Indo-European languages have suggested that the speakers of the proto-language lived 8,000 to 10,000 years ago, a date consistent with the upstart out of Anatolia theory in which they were Europe's first farmers. Most linguists remain skeptical, because this dating contradicts the results of linguistic paleontology. For example, Proto-Indo-European had a word for the wheel, which was invented only 5,500 years ago. The debate over whether the Proto-Indo-Europeans were early farmers or later horsemen rages on, though both theories might be right, and may be true of different historical periods. The really ancient superfamilies, like Nostratic, Amerind, and Eurasiatic, to say nothing of proto-world, are still dismissed by most linguists. So is the idea associated with the human geneticist Luca Cavalli-Sforza that genetic families and language families should coincide. This is sometimes true for very large racial and ethnic groupings, like the speakers of Semitic, Bantu, San, and European languages in Africa, but is far from true in the general sense. The reason is that languages, unlike genes, are not always transmitted vertically from parents to children, but often are transmitted horizontally from conquerors to the conquered, from majorities to immigrants, and from prestigious speakers to déclassé ones. In 2004, 2 geneticists, Alec Knight and Joanna Mountain, came up with a startling claim about proto-world, the ultimate mother tongue spoken by the first modern humans, namely, that it was a click language. Their hypothesis, though certainly not accepted by most linguists, is not crazy speculation, but was based on 4 observations. First, the 2 main families of click languages spoken in Africa, by the Hadza in Tanzania and the sun in the Kalahari Desert are linguistically unrelated in the sense of having no common ancestor within the past 10,000 years. Second, the San and Hadza peoples are genetically unrelated to each other. Third, each group has levels of genetic diversity, suggesting that the two are descendants of the ancestors of all living humans. Fourth, linguists have documented that languages with cliques often lose them, but languages without cliques never originate them. A simple explanation is that the first modern humans, who lived around 100,000 years ago, had a language with cliques which survived in these two African peoples but were lost in all the other descendant groups. Language death is, of course, still a major concern of linguistics. Two organizations that support and document endangered languages are the Foundation for Endangered Languages, www.ogmios.org/home.htm, and the Endangered Language Fund, www.endangeredlanguagefund.org. Chapter 9, Baby Born Talking, Describes Heaven. A nice introduction to how babies talk is a book called How Babies Talk by the psychologists Roberta Golenkoff and Kathy Hirsch Pasek. The evidence that young brains are better than older brains at learning and creating language has been piling up in the last dozen years, and there is evidence for a gradual decline in the ability to master an accent beginning as young as two. Neuroimaging studies suggest that a second language acquired in childhood is processed in the brain in a different way than a second language acquired in adulthood. In the former case, the two languages completely overlap. In the latter, they stake out distinct adjacent regions. At the same time, it's been hard to prove that there is a discrete, critical period for language acquisition. The linguist David Birdsong has suggested that people simply get worse as they get older. Children are better than adolescents, who are better than 20-somethings, who are better than 30-somethings, and so on. Birdsong endorses the hypothesis in this chapter that age effects on language are part of the general process of senescence. The issue is not so easy to resolve because people learn a second language under a wide variety of circumstances and motivations, which could blur any blips or elbows in an age curve. Another complication is that age may play a clearer role in acquiring a first language than a second. Psychologists have long suspected that adults might do a pretty good job at learning a second language by falling back on their first language as a crutch, learning the second in terms of how it differs from the first. A nifty study by Rachel Mayberry, reported just a bit too late for me to have included it in The Language Instinct, bears this out. She found that congenitally deaf people who learned American Sign Language as a first language in adulthood did far worse than people who lost their hearing from an accident or disease and learned it as a second language in adulthood. Congenitally deaf adults who learned ASL as children were, as one would expect, best of all. This confirms that adults are much worse than children at acquiring a language, but that difference is masked by the fact that most adults are learning a second language, not a first one. Age effects in language acquisition have figured in a controversy in American educational policy that might be even more contentious than the reading wars. Until recently, many American states had an eccentric version of bilingual education, in which children of immigrants were taught in their native language, usually Spanish, and English was introduced only gradually, with immersion often delayed until they were on the verge of adolescence. Many academics support these programs, partly because they had a vague aura of being pro-minority and pro-immigrant, despite the opposition of many immigrant parents, the lack of good data showing that the programs helped children, and their underlying assumption that older children are better at acquiring language than younger children. Ron Unz, the activist who spearheaded plebiscites curtailing the programs, pointed out that this is like assuming that rocks fall upward. Chapter 10, Language Organs and Grammar Genes. Aside from the fallout of the genomic revolution, The biggest scientific advance connected with language has been the analysis of the brain through neuroimaging, particularly fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, and MEG, magnetoencephalography. The classic language areas generally come through in these studies, though the overall picture is now far more complicated. The bounty of neuroimaging data on language of the last decade has not led to a neat picture of what parts of the brain do what kinds of work in language, but there have been a few attempts to organize the mess. Peter Haggard has argued that the left inferior frontal lobe is charged with unifying bits of linguistic knowledge, words, rules, sounds, constructions, into a coherent and meaningful sentence. Within this region, Haggard suggests, there is more processing of meaning at the lower front end, more processing of sound and articulation at the upper hindmost end, and more processing of grammar in the middle. Another scheme, by David Peeple and Greg Hickok, focuses on the comprehension side. They suggest that word understanding begins in the general vicinity of Wernicke's area and then splits into two streams. One heads down and forward in the temporal lobe and connects to meaning. The other extends up and then forward to the frontal lobes and connects to articulation. The development of neural circuitry of the brain in utero, which I described in purely hypothetical terms, is another area of biology that has mushroomed in the past dozen years. In his highly readable book, The Birth of the Mind, my former student Gary Marcus explains the basic science behind embryonic brain development and speculates on how the circuits underlying language and cognition might be laid down by genes and early neural activity. Chapter 11. The Big Bang. The evolution of language, which didn't exist as a field when I wrote The Language Instinct, is now the subject of many books, conferences, and research programs. A recent volume called Language Evolution, States of the Art, contains position statements by the major players. I have an essay in it arguing, as I did in this chapter, that language is an adaptation to the cognitive niche in which humans use language to negotiate cooperative relationships and to share technical know-how. The burgeoning field is even the subject of a new popular science book by the journalist Christine Keneally. The most exciting new developments in the field come from the genomic revolution. Several genes or genetic loci with a role in language have been identified, confirming that language is genetically complex and not the result of a single lucky mutation. Even more remarkably, there are new techniques that can analyze genetic variation and distinguish genetic changes which have been naturally selected from those which spread by chance. One method is to see whether the nucleotide changes that affect the protein product, and hence are visible to natural selection, are more numerous than the changes that have no function, and hence must be random evolutionary noise. Another is to see whether a gene shows less variability within the members of a single species than it does between different species. Not only does the FOXP2 gene show these fingerprints of selection, but so do several genes involved in auditory processing in humans, but not in chimpanzees, presumably because of the demands of understanding speech. Another important development is that computational evolutionary linguistics is no longer a one-man enterprise. My colleague Martin Novak has developed several mathematical models that add teeth to the intuition that some of the basic design features of language confer selective advantages to intelligent social agents. These include syntactic rules that express complex meanings, and the so-called duality of patterning, in which phonemes are combined into words and words are combined into sentences. In 1995, I took part in a conference at UCLA in which Sue Savage Rumbaugh announced that someday she expected Kanzi, the pygmy chimpanzee she had trained with symbol systems, to be giving her talks for her. We're still waiting. Though I think that Kanzi and other bonobos can understand and use words with greater reliability than had been shown when I wrote The Language Instinct, their ability to combine them remains rudimentary. Indeed, the striking achievements in animal communication have been seen in species that are far more distantly related to us than chimpanzees. The most receptive trainee for an artificial language with a syntax and semantics has been a parrot. The species with the best claim to recursive structure in its signaling has been the starling. The best vocal imitators are birds and dolphins. And when it comes to reading human intentions, chimps are bested by man's best friend, Canis familiaris. This pattern bears out my advisory that it's a mistake to ask about language in animals, as if there were some evolutionary gradient with humans at the top and chimpanzees one rung down. Instead, animals at different positions in the tree of life evolved the cognitive and communicative abilities that are useful to them in their ecological niches. Humans are still the only species that naturally develops a communicative system with a combinatorial syntax and semantics befitting our unique occupation of the cognitive niche. In an unusual collaboration, Chomsky wrote a paper in Science in 2002 with the comparative psychologists Mark Hauser and Tecumseh Fitch that sought to bridge the rift between linguistics and animal behavior research. The authors distinguished between language in a broad sense, namely the entire set of abilities that go into speaking and understanding, concepts, memory, hearing, planning, vocalizing, and language in a narrow sense, namely the abilities that are unique to language and unique to humans. They suggested that the broad language faculty contains many abilities we share with other animals, but that the narrow language faculty consists only of syntactic recursion. As I have mentioned, Ray Jackendoff and I were unpersuaded and expressed our reservations in a debate in the pages of Cognition. Chapter 12. The Language Mavens. This was by far the most widely noticed chapter in the book. Despite my statement to the contrary, many readers assumed that I was opposed to any kind of encouragement of standard grammar or good style. Some assumed that I was advocating a 1960s-style attitude of doing your own thing, letting it all hang out, and taking a walk on the wild side. As a radical language libertine, I even made an appearance as a character in David Foster Wallace's novel Infinite Jest. In fact, the chapter simply publicized what everyone who has studied the history of English soon discovers. Many prescriptive rules, despite being cited with an air of dogmatic certitude and haughty one-upmanship, are pure twaddle and have no basis in logic, style, clarity, or literary precedent. I do feel bad at having had some fun at the expense of the witty writers Richard Lederer and William Safire, especially after the New Republic excerpted the chapter with a title and cover that took some gratuitous digs at Safire. When I met him a year later, he was gracious about the episode, and he has occasionally consulted with me for his columns since then. The same cannot be said for John Simon, who surmised in the National Review that I was trying to excuse the bad grammar of my uneducated parents. My call for a language maven who thinks like a linguist has been answered by Jan Freeman, who writes an unfailingly insightful column called The Word in the Boston Globe. And my call for linguists who address style and usage has been answered by Jeffrey Pullum and Mark Lieberman in their delightful blog called Language Log, with occasional contributions from Jeffrey Nunberg, John McWhorter, and other linguists. Chapter 13. Mind Design. I have expanded the content of this chapter into two books, How the Mind Works, which is about the other cognitive and emotional instincts that make up human nature, and The Blank Slate, which is about the idea of human nature and its political, moral, and emotional colorings. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Language Instinct, How the Mind Creates Language, by Steven Pinker. Copyright 1994 by Steven Pinker. Performed by Arthur Morey. Directed by John Baker. Performance copyright 2011 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number. 1-800-222-3225. Or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.